Good evening.
Good evening.
Okay, so did everybody do their homework? Or at least got a good dent into it, I certainly hope. All right. So a couple of housekeeping things for tonight. First of all, thanks to Yvonne Lalo. Where are you?
Right here in the yellow.
Oh my gosh, like right in front of my face, yeah. Okay, we have sweets, so we can sweeten the deal for Soccer Sanctuarium tonight. So feel free during the class to come up and take some of these goodies back to your seat with you. We also have our friends from St. Benedict's who are here, so we're very grateful to have them, and they have all kinds of wonderful stuff there if you're looking for things to purchase during or after class. Since this is the month of October, which is the month traditionally dedicated to Our Lady of the Rosary, why don't we start tonight's festivities with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Hail Mary.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Our Lady, Queen of Peace. St. John the 23rd.
Pray for us.
Blessed Paul the 6th.
Pray for us.
St. John Paul the 2nd. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, let's get right into it. Sacra Sanctum Concilium, the liturgy document. You thought I was going to start with 1962, didn't you? Wrong. 1832, we're going way back. 1832, a young diocesan priest with a dream. You've got to be careful with those types, don't you? Something a little bit dangerous. Diocesan priest with a dream succeeded in buying an abandoned monastery at a little place called Solem in France. And the next year, with five priest friends, went about re-establishing Benedictine monastic life in its purity and austerity. Prosper Guéranger was a romantic. Remember, this is the kind of reaction to the Enlightenment of the 18th century. He was a romantic and a Catholic, and he wanted to live the liturgy, not in a reduced form, but in all of its splendor. Now remember, this is after the French Revolution, after the Napoleonic Wars, all of this kind of stuff, and he yearned for a vigorous, imaginative practice of our Catholic faith. And he saw in so many places the few faithful that still went to Mass after the revolutionary period. And the few faithful who went to Mass, many of them had absolutely no idea what was going on, and it didn't really seem like they cared all that much either. But as he delved into the actual texts of the liturgy and its history, he saw that the liturgy could be a cornerstone of a renewal of Christian life and society. And his monastery was put on the map very quickly as the congregation of monks and their zeal for the liturgy spread. If you ever hear the word Gregorian chant, usually Solem is the first thing that comes to mind, because these are the people who actually restored Gregorian chant after centuries of just kind of, being in the waste paper basket, as it were. The Benedictines were the heralds of what would soon come to be known as the liturgical movement. And if we're going to understand Sacra Sanctum Concilium, we have to understand what this movement was, where it came from, and where it is, where it was going on the eve of the council and where it is now. Guéranger wrote this 15-volume series. If you want something to look pretty on your bookshelf that's actually useful, you want to get this. It's called The Liturgical Year. It spread throughout the Catholic intellectual world, and anybody who was anybody had to visit these monastic centers of beautiful and precisely executed Roman liturgy. Abbeys like Mont-Cesar in Belgium, Beuron and Maria Lach in Germany, Kloster Neuburg in Austria, although they weren't actually Benedictines, Farnborough in England became places of pilgrimage. All of a sudden these places started appearing on the map and people were like, oh my gosh, you want to go somewhere with some beautiful liturgy? Here's where you go. But these monastic liturgists were not just about living the liturgy. It became a scholarly passion for them. Books began to come about by the scores. The abbot of Maria Lach, Odo Kazel, wrote The Mystery of Christian Worship, which became very influential. Lambert Baudouin, who founded the Abbey of Chevetonne, which would be both Western and Eastern Rite, provided a theological and even an ecumenical framework for the historical study of the liturgy. Now, the thing is, though, is that most of this liturgical movement just kind of stayed behind monastery walls. And very few people thought that it could work outside of the monastery. They're like, "What, y'all are a bunch of monks. All you do is pray and sing all the time. Of course you can do this in a wonderful, beautiful way. This ain't going to work in your parish. It's just not going to happen." But there were men who said, "You know what? Maybe the monks are onto something. Maybe we can do something like this outside of the monasteries." And they started thinking, "Well, how can this work?" And this is where we have a divergence of two schools of thought about the liturgy and Christian life. It wasn't apparent at the time that two different schools were developing, but it became apparent later on. The Austrian canon, Pius Parsch, it's a very important name to know, started to experiment with the liturgy in his parish. He revived the offertory procession. You know, when we go to Mass now and, the ushers choose, a family to bring up the bread and the wine. Well, that hadn't happened in centuries in the Catholic Church. Pius Parsch and his little parish outside of Klosterneuburg started to do that. He encouraged the use of missals with German on one side and Latin on the other. Those of you who may remember the Mass before Vatican II remember the hand missals, right? Well, those are actually a relatively recent invention for the faithful. Pius Parsch was the one who's like, "Yeah, this is great. Get these texts into the hands of the faithful." He maximized the use of German music at the Mass. Meanwhile, while this is going on, Romano Guardini, this is another really useful name to know, an Italian-born theology professor in Switzerland, was a chaplain to Catholic students in secular universities. And he wrote a book called The Spirit of the Liturgy. This is a really wonderful text if you're looking for something else to read, as if I haven't given y'all enough to read during this class, but that's for after the Vatican II class. And in this book, he posited how the liturgy could revive not only Christian life, but civilization itself. The idea is that if we get the liturgy right, and we get Catholics to really take ownership of the liturgy, then civilization as we know it can be absolutely changed for the good. Now, why is this important? Romano Guardini, in 1917, said the first Mass facing the people in the crypt church of the Benedictine Monastery of Maria Laje. And he made certain changes to the liturgy during his very popular student masses. Now, let's get closer to home. This is all stuff happening in Europe. The United States, had a very pragmatic attitude towards all this kind of European intellectual ferment, right? I mean, Americans were very practical people, right? And America was largely untouched by this movement until the 1940s. Remember that part of the American experience of Catholicism, but most Catholics were immigrants, right? And the two kind of polar opposites when it comes to the liturgy were the Irish and the Germans. So the Irish prelates, the bishops and monsignors and all that kind of stuff, they love them some low mass. 20 minutes, get in, get out, and get off to breakfast, right? Okay. And in fact, when I see someone who comes up to me and, "Father, oh my gosh, can't you get mass done in 30 minutes? I think you've got to be Irish, don't you?" So 99% of the time, I'm right. Okay. Now, and remember that the Irish, they didn't have this thing for a lot of music. Because remember the Irish experience. They were persecuted by the English, who of course had these grand cathedral schools and this beautiful liturgical life. So they associated all of that with heresy, as well as with their oppressors. Now, on the other side, you have the Germans, who they loved them some music, right? So, these huge orchestral masses and, these beautiful ceremonies, that was kind of their thing. So we see that in America, we have these two entirely different poles. Choir schools were born, like the Pius X School of Liturgical Music in Manhattanville, New York, where Justine Ward, Vow of the Holy Name of Justine Ward, she really was an incredible woman, a laywoman who had studied Gregorian chant in Salem almost single-handedly revived chant in the United States. Justine Ward developed a method for teaching chant to little children. And I was able to study this method when I was in college, and I've done some of it here, and our music staff do this here. It was absolutely amazing when you get these little children who are able to open these ancient manuscripts and just sing from them. She was able to develop a method to revive the chant in the United States for children. Then, there's another guy. Okay, these people, they're like my best friends. They're just absolutely wonderful people. Monsignor Martin Hellriegel. Who was the pastor of Holy Cross in St. Louis, Missouri, brought about an amazing conversion of his parish, school, and convent by teaching the liturgy. And when he started to do this in his parish, he had a parish which is basically, you know, 30-minute low masses, get in and get out, and, you know, let's learn our catechism, and that's all we need. And so the parents of the school were like, okay, Monsignor, seriously, we cannot run our lives by the bells of the Angelus, right? You know, these children were coming home and singing from the Kyrie Romanum and all this kind of stuff. And we're like, what are you doing? But then they saw how happy the children were, and they're like, oh, well, maybe there's something on to this. He did an incredible amount of work in this one parish. Virgil Michel, who is a monk of St. John's Abbey in Collegeville, Minnesota, inflamed the nascent social movement in the church with his essays on the relationship between liturgy and social renewal. In the liturgical movement, the idea was that social justice has its root in our worship. That if we worship God in the body of Christ, in the Eucharist, then we also have to extend that worship into the world, to the body of Christ who is suffering and broken in our brothers and sisters in the world, and establishing these links. And there was all kinds of other people that I could go on and on and on in the United States. The United States had an incredible liturgical movement that started around the 1940s. Now, remember we talked about this separation, right, between the monastic and this kind of parish-based liturgical movement. Where the separation was is that Guardini and the parish-based liturgical movement were convinced that the Mass had to be changed in order to bring about that active and conscious participation which would then effect a renewal of Christian life. Liturgical scholarship at the time, remember that there had not been a lot of really serious study about the history of the liturgy. It was just kind of like, well, yeah, we're Catholics and we kind of do Mass, and that's what we do. There wasn't a lot of, until this period, of serious study of its history. It made it clear that Mass, as was celebrated at many places at the time, was not like it was in the earliest centuries. And so proposals were made to modernize the liturgy by making it more in conformity with the ancient rites and piety. During this time, it was routine to downplay anything medieval and Baroque. So often from the literature you see, oh, all these horrifying medieval accretions and all this Baroque nonsense. You know, all of this kind of, you know, ugh, this is just horrible stuff, we need to get rid of it. The watchword was for antiquity as being closer to purity. Now, many of the monastic-based liturgical movement devotees, however, insisted that, you know, changing the Mass is not going to change people's hearts. That what the church needed to do was elevate the people to the level of the liturgy, not dumb it down. Okay, so you can see these are two radically different divergent schools of thought. Now, these were never seen in terms of liberal and conservative. Remember we talked about in last class that, you know, the media kind of forced or straight-jacketed the discussion of the council into these two kind of American political terms. And those things have plagued any discussion during and after Vatican II. You know, so often people will hear certain things about the liturgy and think, oh, you must be a liberal or you must be a conservative, especially in the United States. And this isn't necessarily the case in other countries, but our experience has been kind of conditioned by this. Many thinkers found themselves on one side and then another at different times, or as Monsignor Hellriegel said after Vatican II, before the council, I was considered to be a dangerous modernist. Now they think I'm an ultra-conservative reactionary, and I haven't changed one bit. And much of the discussion about the liturgy today has its ultimate root not in a supposed liberal or conservative theology, as much as in this unresolved conflict from the pre-conciliar liturgical movement. Okay. Now, remember I asked you to read Pius XII's encyclical Mediator Dei. Okay. Now, let's fast forward. We started in 1832. Let's get to 1947. Okay. 1947, by the time it rolls around, the liturgical movement in all of its forms had conquered the theological elite and made headway into parishes as well. Pius XII lauds the movement. This is paragraph 5. In Mediator Dei, quote, "The majestic ceremonies of the sacrifice of the altar became better known, understood, and appreciated. With more widespread and more frequent reception of the sacraments, with the beauty of the prayers more fully savored, the worship of the Eucharist came to be regarded for what it really is, the fountainhead of genuine Christian devotion." Now, he also warns that not everything was all right with all this. Okay, paragraph 7. "Duty obliges us to give serious attention to this revival as it is advocated in some quarters, and to take proper steps to preserve it from excess or outright perversion." He's like, okay, not everything that they're saying here is necessarily a good thing. "Because," paragraph 8, "certain enthusiasts, overeager in their search for novelty, are straying beyond the path of sound doctrine and prudence," end quote. One of the chief themes of Mediator Dei, so this beautiful document by Pius XII, is this. Worship is an interior action, paragraph 24. "And therefore," paragraph 25, "it is an error to think of the sacred liturgy as merely the outward or visible part of divine worship, or as an ornamental ceremonial." Now, a lot of the proponents of the movement focused on the alteration of the external signs of the liturgy to the detriment of the formation of the people to be nourished spiritually by the liturgy. And Pius XII already foresees the danger of arbitrary experimentation in the liturgy. Paragraph 57. "The Church has used her right of control over liturgical observance to protect the purity of divine worship against abuse from dangerous and imprudent innovations introduced by private individuals and particular churches." End quote. Much of this experimentation tended to devalue Latin, and so he comments, paragraph 60, "The use of the Latin language, customary in a considerable portion of the Church, is a manifest and beautiful sign of unity, as well as an effective antidote for any corruption of doctrinal truth. In spite of this, the use of the mother tongue in connection with several of the rites may be of much advantage to the people." So he's already saying in 1947 that, okay, the vernacular, we need to give some space here for that. He also highlights the role of Gregorian chant in the liturgy, paragraph 191. "Gregorian chant, which the Roman Church considers her own as handed down from antiquity and kept under her close tutelage, is proposed to the faithful as belonging to them also. In certain parts of the liturgy, the Church definitely prescribes it. It makes the celebration of the sacred mysteries not only more dignified and solemn, but helps very much to increase the faith and devotion of the congregation." End quote. Now, perhaps the most serious prophecy that Pius XII makes is that the liturgical movement will sow great confusion over the difference between how the clergy and the laity offer the same sacrifice, and thus devalue not only the sacrament of holy orders, but also mutate the true Catholic understanding of the Eucharist as sacrifice. Paragraph 41. "The visible external priesthood of Jesus Christ is not handed down indiscriminately to all members of the Church in general, but is conferred on designated men through what may be called the spiritual generation of holy orders." Okay. "Since, therefore, it is the priest chiefly performs the sacred liturgy in the name of the Church, its organization, regulation, and details cannot but be subject to Church authority. This conclusion, based on the nature of Christian worship itself, is further confirmed by the testimony of history." It's paragraph 43. Then, paragraph 68, "The august sacrifice of the altar, then, is no mere empty commemoration of the passion and death of Christ, but a true and proper act of sacrifice, whereby the high priest, by an unbloody immolation, offers himself a most acceptable victim to the Eternal Father, as he did upon the cross. It is one and the same victim. The same person now offers it by the ministry of his priest, who then offered himself on the cross, the manner of offering alone being different." Okay, why is this important? Okay. Some of the most heated debates about liturgy over the past 50 years have centered on the role of the laity in worship and the relationship between the Mass as a meal over the Mass as a sacrifice. Right? The Mass is a meal. Okay, it is a meal, but it is also a sacrifice. You have to uphold, you know, both ends of the chain. Pius XII saw that there was tendencies that were happening that could be really injurious to the faith. And we'll see this again as Sacrosanctum Concilium comes near. Pius XII issues Mediator Dei in 1947, and the bishops of the world are very well acquainted with what is contained in it and other papal pronouncements on the liturgy. After 1947, this division between the two streams of the liturgical movement gets wider. And contrary to Pius XII, more calls for experimentation and change begin to be made. By 1962, each one of the Council Fathers had in their minds not only the work of Pius XII, but also the clamoring of intellectuals and lay faithful influenced by both sides of the liturgical movement. Okay? So you see that this is kind of building momentum by the time we get to 1962. Now, remember in our first class, when we talked about how the intentio auctoris, the intention of the authors, is crucial to understand any word, decision, or declaration, whether it be an ecumenical council or anything, it doesn't matter what it is. The intention of the author is the key to interpreting its meaning. And such an intention, when it is not evident in the text itself, can begin to be surmised by other things written by the author or anecdotal evidence surrounding what was written. Okay. Now, apply this to everything that's going on here. Such research proves that regardless of what might have been the expectations of many priests, religious, and laity in Northern Europe in the early 1960s, the bishops assembled at the Second Vatican Council did not expect the liturgy to change drastically. How do we know this? The flood of autobiographies of bishops who were at the council, okay, and on various sides of various fences, proves that when they were voting on Sacrosanctum Concilium's final draft, which was overwhelmingly approved, 2,159 yes to 19 no votes, they never could have foreseen the liturgy as it is celebrated in so many places today. The final vote was 2,147 in favor, 4 against. It was to be the most unified vote of any of the council documents. Okay. So what were they thinking when they voted? Okay, this is a legitimate question. Okay, we have to understand the intentio auctoris. What was in their mind when they put this up here? Well, if you have a chance to go to any of these kind of large theological libraries with great resources, you can find a series of large folio volumes which are called the Acta Concilii Vaticani Secondi. Now you're thinking, Father, stop with the Latin. Okay, well, the thing is, there's a reason why I'm giving it to you in Latin. Okay. Now, this thing, it goes on for hundreds of thousands of pages. Okay, so I'm not going to give you, this is your homework. Right, okay. They include every word which was pronounced on the council floor and every written piece of paper which was officially given to the bishops. Okay, because as each bishop got up to speak, they submitted first in writing a copy of their Latin talk. And these talks were called relationes. In them, you can find out much more of what was going on in the fathers' reasoning and debating than what can be had from the documents themselves. I mean, obviously the documents are the important part, right? But if you want to see, okay, what did they think they were voting on? What were they asking for? What was there? You got to go back to the relationes. Now, of course, they're all in Latin. They've never been translated. But they are absolutely crucial for understanding the study of the council. What is clear from them, as from the vast majority of what was written after the council by the bishops themselves, was that regardless of what they thought after the council, at the time of the vote on Sacrosanctum Concilium, the bishops were approving a document which they thought would enshrine relatively small changes to the Mass, but big changes to the way the faithful participated in the Mass. Okay? There was a great desire to achieve the goals of the liturgical movement,
but to see within the church an active interior participation in the sacred rites as a means of Christian living. Now, regardless of what was actually written in Pius XII or Sacrosanctum Concilium, or what was on the minds of the bishops when they lined up to vote on the document, the reality is that almost every Catholic alive experienced worship in a vastly different way than they did before. Now, for most people, if you ask most people, what did Vatican II bring to the church? They're going to tell you in terms of liturgy, because it's what they saw happen at Mass, what was different than what was happening before. So for many people, Vatican II was a revolution. And it made the liturgy and what one thought about the liturgy a litmus test for how other Catholics would view their co-religionists. Okay. You know, before, people just went to Mass. You know, usually you just went to Mass at the church that was closest to you. Okay. And there's still people who do that. Now, the way that the liturgy is celebrated, in one sense, this is a good thing because it means that Catholics take the liturgy seriously. Right? If they don't feel comfortable at a place where they go to Mass, then they're going to shop around until they find where they are. Okay. So there's a positive thing in that there's a greater engagement with the liturgy. But at the same time, there's also the issue, have we kind of, you know, are we experiencing a greater disunity? And why is that the case? And is there anything that can happen to resolve it? Or is it just legitimate diversity within the church? Now, this experience, though, was pretty novel in Catholic history. Remember, there is a Latin axiom, which you've heard me say at Mass, I'm sure. Lex orandi, lex credendi, which goes back to Prosper of Aquitaine. Lex orandi, lex credendi. The law of prayer is the law of belief. Okay? There is a huge connection between these two things. This meant that in centuries past, those who disagreed with the church's teaching would change the rites to reflect their belief. Now, for the first time in anybody's memory, the church was changing her rites, or so it appeared. So was she also changing her belief? That is why studying this document of Vatican II closely is so crucial to answering that question. Okay. When you, and you've read the document, I hope, so preparation for class today. As you read the document, it is apparent that there is no desire to change the church's teaching on anything. Remember John the 23rd's opening speech to the council, Gaudet Mater Ecclesia. Semper eodem aquae sententia, okay, in the same meaning as before. There is not a desire to restore some kind of liturgical utopia from the ancient world. This is not part of Sacrosanctum Concilium. What one does find is a serious pastoral concern to restore the liturgy to its central place in Christian life. Sacrosanctum Concilium, paragraph 10, quote, "The liturgy is the summit toward which the activity of the church is directed. At the same time, it is the font from which all of her power flows." There's a concern to restore the liturgy to a state in which it could be more easily participated in by greater numbers of the faithful, without losing its proper nature or watering it down. Paragraph 21. Holy Mother Church desires to undertake with great care a general restoration of the liturgy itself. For the liturgy is made up of immutable elements divinely instituted, and of elements subject to change. These not only may, but ought to be changed with the passage of time, if they have suffered from the intrusion of anything out of harmony with the inner nature of the liturgy or have become unsuited to it. Okay. So the idea is that the liturgy is not this absolute immutable fixed thing, which always is and always will be, that the church does have the power to change the sacred liturgy. Okay, now, paragraphs 21 to 46, if you want to get to the real meat of Sacrosanctum Concilium in terms of what does this look like, not just kind of theologically or conceptually, but for the Mass itself, paragraphs 21 to 46 sets out general principles by which the church hierarchy would guide a reform of the liturgy after Vatican II. Now, as you read those paragraphs, thinking about the Mass as was celebrated before, and then compare it to many places in which you have been to Mass now, then it's easy to see that many of today's liturgies are not exactly what is being talked about in the document, right?
Okay, you're reading this and you're like, wait a minute, so I didn't see that at Mass last week. I've never seen this. Or I went to vacation in Florida and this isn't like that what happened there at all, right? Okay, so how did this happen? Okay, now we're going to go way back. You know how I love my history lessons. So, before 1588, there was no central governing agency in the Roman Church for liturgical questions. Until 1588, it just kind of happened, right? Popes and bishops, I mean, they wrote letters and they passed laws and stuff, but there was no kind of official organ for doing so. Pope Sixtus V established the Sacred Congregation for Rites in 1588. And Pope Pius X in 1908 established another congregation for the discipline of the sacraments. Fast forward, Paul VI united them in 1969 to what finally came to be known in 1988 as the Congregation for Divine Worship and Discipline of the Sacraments, the longest title of any dicastery of the Vatican. Now, from 1588 all the way through, this is the organ of the Pope that deals with all this kind of stuff. So it was assumed, naturally, that this congregation would oversee the work of the liturgical reform. Okay. Now remember, Sacrosanctum Concilium is signed, okay? And as soon as it was signed, Paul VI stated that nothing would change until the first Sunday of Lent, 1964. And even then, he said, just hold your horses, because this is going to take a while. Okay. As soon as this, remember we talked about these different types of documents. Motu proprio. A motu proprio is a type of document, basically by one's own initiative, by one's own motion. So Paul VI, on his own, issues this document called a motu proprio. As soon as this was published, in which he said, okay, don't even think about doing anything until the first Sunday of Lent, we're going to tell you what to do, and just chill out. Okay. As soon as this happened, bishops stormed the Secretariat of State with phone calls, telegrams, cablegrams, telex, all the stuff that they had in the 1960s. And it became evident that the bishops are like, we're going to do this on our own. And the entire French episcopate said, we're not going to wait for anything. They just took it entirely out of the hands of the Roman Curia. Now, the prelates, okay, the bishops, the cardinals who were part of the Congregation for Rites, they had been very skeptical of the liturgical reform from the beginning. And they were just beginning, I mean, they're like, well, how on earth are we even supposed to start to do this? When in a 3-day period, an altered official Latin translation of Paul VI's motu proprio appeared, which was drastically different than the original that they read in the Vatican's newspaper, Le Sovratore Romano. That the Pope had taken the responsibility for the liturgical reform entirely out of their hands, establishing a committee called Concilium. With Cardinal Leccaro, who was the Archbishop of Bologna, who was a bitter enemy of the recently decessed prefect of the Congregation for Rites, Gaetano Cicognani, and Annibale Bonini. Does this name sound familiar? Remember him from our first class. Okay. We're going to keep coming back to him. Father Annibale Bonini was the Secretary of Concilium. This is the same man who, remember, would be removed from the Vatican for his purported Masonic activity, which was never proved, against the Church. Now, Bonini was the mastermind behind much of the liturgical reform. When he was exiled, he wrote a 928-page defense of himself and his work called The Reform of the Liturgy. Now remember, he had been the lone secretary for matters liturgical in the Vatican since Pius XII installed him in 1954. Okay, he had complete access to all of the data, every meeting, every scrap of paper, everything that happened about the liturgy from 1954 onward. And in his book, he has this consistent theme, and he expresses it in chapter 10, and I think that this is crucial for us to understand the mindset. He says, quote, how difficult it is to take an ancient building in hand and make it functional and habitable without changing the structure. Peripheral alterations are not enough. There has to be a radical restoration. End quote. Now, Paul VI, at a private audience on January the 22nd, 1968, told Bonini specifically and wrote it down, quote, as far as possible, changes in the current form of the Mass should be avoided.
Now, during this time, the Reformed Missal, what we have now, is what we call the ordinary form, the Novus Ordo. It was called as a draft the normative mass, the Missa Normativa, was the fruit of conciliums consistently blocking the congregation of rites and not including them in on the project that had been in the planning for years. So remember what I said, January 22nd, 1968, Paul VI writes specifically, don't be changing stuff. Paul VI wrote a handwritten note on November 6, 1968, which stated, I give the new order of Mass my approval in the Lord. That note was not delivered to the new prefect of the Congregation for Rites, Cardinal Gutt, until January the 17th of the next year. Okay. Bonini had what had became known, what we know now, as the Novus Ordo Missae, published on April the 3rd, 1969, with the Apostolic Constitution, that's the type of document which accompanied it, Missale Romanum, dictating it should be used by Advent of 1969. So that meant that you had this very small window of opportunity to come up with translations. Okay. Remember that when we came up with the new English translation in 2011, okay, the kind of impetus for that came originally from a document from 1994 and then from the year 2000 with the new General Instruction of the Roman Missal. That was 11 years of a process. They didn't even have 11 months to get this thing translated. It's really incredible. It's a story. This was the quickest thing that the Vatican has ever done in 2,000 years. Okay. It was a massive liturgical reform which was imposed on the church without even the Congregation for Rites knowing that it was happening. Okay. It was all engineered by Bonini to the virtual exclusion of the Vatican Agency for the Liturgy. Now, as soon as the new missal was published, Concilium was disbanded. No mas. Okay. And ordinary care for the liturgy was put back into the hands of a newly organized congregation for rites. By the time John Paul II ascended to the throne of Peter in 1979, there was absolute and complete liturgical confusion in the Catholic Church, absolutely everywhere. The attempts of the Congregation for Divine Worship to stop the abuses, nobody cared, nobody listened. Throughout the pontificate of John Paul II, documents were issued from both the Pope himself and the Roman Curia trying to curb the abuses. So this is all under JP2. Dominica Cene, 1980. Liturgium Authenticum, 1994. Ecclesia de Eucharistia, which was 2003. Redemptionis Sacramentum, which was 2004. And in the year 2000, there was a new edition of the General Instruction of the Roman Missal in 2000. So already by 1980, when John Paul II's Dominica Cene came out, it was very clear, it's like, okay, we got to do something here because this is getting kind of out of hand and kind of crazy. These documents are wonderful. There's only one problem with these documents, though. No one reads them. If you ask most bishops and priests, if you go up to any random guy in a Roman collar and you ask them, have you read Redemptionis Sacramentum? Have you read the General Instruction of the Roman Missal? Right. They haven't read the documents. They have not read the documents. It is absolutely incredible. When I was ordained a priest in 2005, because remember, I was in the seminary when all this kind of stuff was you know, coming out, right? And we never once in my seminary education read any of this. Any of the documents that accompanied the new revised liturgical rites. Not once in 5 years that I was in the seminary. Now, I did on my own because I'm like, hey, this is kind of important, right? But we were never asked to do this. And this was in the Pope's personal seminary for the Diocese of Rome. This is a problem. Okay. When we wonder why liturgical celebrations are so crazy in certain places, if people are not reading Sacrosanctum Concilium, as well as all these other documents, then it's not surprising that we have problems. Now, had everyone actually taken to heart the wise counsel of Pius XII in Mediator Dei? He said, don't mess around with this stuff, right? You can't just randomly just do stuff. It has to be consistent with things. If people had read these documents and taken them to heart and obeyed the church's magisterial teaching with these things, we'd be in a very different position than we are now. But so many people have just ignored these things. And there's a wealth of beautiful teaching in these documents. There really is. And the General Instruction of the Roman Missal kind of reads like a telephone book. I know that we don't have those anymore, but, you know, so because it's an instruction manual for the Mass. So, you know, it's not the most exciting reading. But there's a lot of beautiful theology and spirituality in all of these other documents. Now, most of us realize that much of the confusion of so many things comes from ideas which really have nothing to do with the council at all. And after our lecture tonight, we're going to go back to my quiz, remember, that I gave y'all last week to go over the readings, but we'll do that afterwards. Now, many of the things which people think Vatican II said were not actually said by Vatican II, but they were written in documents after the fact. Okay, now, I want you to bear with me because this is you know, going to be getting into high cotton here. There's a lot of kind of craziness here. The problem is that these documents are so numerous that it is trying to find a needle in a haystack to find anything in them. Liturgical Press publishes a book called Documents on the Liturgy, 1963 to 1979. Okay, these are official documents on the liturgy. It is 1,496 pages worth of stuff. And among these pages, remember, that's just up to 1979. Okay, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that's come out since then. And remember, as we talked about in our first class, that all these documents, they're not of equal weight. So it's hard to kind of realize, okay, well, where are we with these things? Furthermore, the contradictions between them are so maddening that I really, because remember that, you know, my training in all of this was to be a theology professor, okay? And so I really wanted to grab a doctoral student one day and say, you sit down and you go through 1,496 pages of text and document all the contradictions. Because it is insane. Because what happens is that there's a question about something in the liturgy, right? So people are like, I'm going to find the answer. So let's go to the internet, the source of all wisdom and knowledge, right? So Google washing women's feet on Holy Thursday, right? And then all of a sudden, you find everything under the sun, okay? You don't know what has proper weight, what is when, you know, what is it more important, what came later, what came first, or, you know, is it, you know, what comes from the bishop's conference, or what comes from my pastor, or what comes from the pope? I mean, it's just maddening, right? And they contradict each other. It's really, really quite crazy. The clarity of authority in matters liturgical has been drowned in paper. And that's just the official stuff from the Vatican. Right. Multiply the official chaos by the number of proclamations by individual bishops, bishops' conferences, liturgists, university professors, parish priests, and lay writers, and you have a huge mess on your hands. I'm sorry?
Lack of communication.
It is really quite fascinating. Now, it's useful to search for answers to these questions, but I'm going to tell you, don't be surprised if you don't find the answer to them, because that's just kind of the situation we have now. But it also has to be taken into consideration. Here is something that is really important. When you read all of these documents, you know, if you want to sit there because you have no life to go through 1,496 pages of the documents from 1963 to 1979, even I am not that much of a liturgy geek. Okay. So, when you are looking through this, you have to take into consideration that there is a background which naturally has more authority. And it is the practice of the Roman basilicas. When Bunini is engineering all this stuff, he is not thinking, well, what's going on in a suburban American parish? He does not care. That is not on his radar screen. It is what was happening and what was supposed to be happening in the Roman basilicas. And when we read these rubrics and these documents and all these things, it's important to say, okay, what's going on in the actual practice that's there? If we understand that, certain things make sense. If we go to, St. Whosie-What's-It's in Poughkeepsie, New York, or wherever, just to say, then that is not what the documents are kind of presuming when they talk about these questions. Now, the gold standard for any liturgical document, okay, remember, because there's all kinds of stuff here, right? But the gold standard, the thing that you have to compare everything against, is Sacrosanctum Concilium. Okay? How faithful is it to this, to Sacrosanctum Concilium? Once you've accepted, okay, the text of the conciliar constitution,
as well as Benedict XVI's concept of hermeneutical continuity. Remember, we talked about that, the key to interpretation. Then, sifting through all of this chaos brings you back to how the rites are supposed to be carried out, given the theological vision of Sacrosanctum Concilium and the practice of the Roman Church as consistent with and not departing from the tradition before it. Does that make sense? So, because otherwise, you know, we have total chaos. Now, I want to go forward a little bit. Joseph Ratzinger. Yeah. Okay.
A reason why it was supposed to be done this way in the basilicas, was that because the basilicas were the bishops and the smaller churches and the parish communities were supposed to follow and emulate?
Well, remember that the Roman liturgy, the Roman liturgy is basically the liturgy of the Roman basilicas. That's what the Roman liturgy is. So when the Roman liturgy was carried outside of the city of Rome, what was being taken was the practice of the Roman basilicas. That is the Roman liturgy, is the practice of the Roman basilicas. Not just kind of, you know, how any individual place kind of interpreted that. Okay. Now, Cardinal Ratzinger, you cannot talk about Vatican II without talking about Joseph Ratzinger. We talked about that from the first. You can't get away from him anywhere in all of this. As a theologian, he had written many things on the liturgy before his election as Pope. Remember how he talked about those German-Latin hand missals? You know, he got a hand missal for like his first communion, and he was like, oh my gosh, this is like the coolest thing ever. And he's been thinking about the liturgy ever since he was 7. Right, okay. Now, he is an heir to that classical Benedictine school of the liturgical movement, and sought to apply its principles amidst the liturgical chaos of the present day. Now, for saying that, though, he's not dismissive of the pastoral and revisionist school of the liturgical movement. Okay? Remember we talked about Romano Guardini. His text, The Spirit of the Liturgy, inspired Ratzinger in the year 2000 to write a book which in English is given the same title. In the preface for the book, he writes, and I'm going to quote this entire paragraph. It's really cool. Okay. We might say that in 1918, the year that Guardini published his book, the liturgy was rather like a fresco. It had been preserved from damage, but had been almost completely overlaid with whitewash by later generations. In the missal from which the priest celebrated, the form of the liturgy that had grown from its earliest beginnings was still present. As far as the faithful were concerned, it was largely concealed beneath instructions for and forms of private prayer. The fresco was laid bare by the liturgical movement and in a definitive way by the Second Vatican Council. For a moment, its colors and figures fascinated us. But since then, the fresco has been endangered by climactic conditions as well as by various restorations and reconstructions. In fact, it is threatened with destruction if the necessary steps are not taken to stop these damaging influences. Of course, there must be no question of its being covered with a whitewash again. But what is imperative is a new reverence in the way we treat it, a new understanding of its message and its reality, so that the rediscovery does not become the first stage of irreparable loss. End quote. That is a beautiful image for where the liturgy was and where it is right now, I think. In this book, he is basically calling for a reform of the reform. Now, several things have been kind of happening during all of this. This whole kind of concept of the reform of the reform. There's a whole new generation of liturgical scholars that has arisen that have flatly shown to be false much of the liturgical scholarship on which much of the liturgical thinking of the early 20th century, especially of the non-classical branch of the liturgical movement, is based. Okay. Remember that liturgical history was just kind of getting started because of the work of the monks of Salem. There's a few kind of serious things that happened there. I mean, you know, there was a couple things in the 18th century and the 17th century, which are all quite interesting for people who are liturgy nerds. But the big thing was the 19th century. But remember, they're just getting started with all this stuff. And a lot of assumptions were made, which now we know were just not really the case or are a lot more complicated. Klaus Gamber wrote a book which really kind of was the first volley of the kind of reform of the reform.
It is called the Reform of the Roman Liturgy, and it gives lie to the argument advanced by liturgists of a previous era, that in the ancient church, Mass was said facing the people, and that there was great liturgical creativity in antiquity.
Right.
The scholarship of the early 20th century basically kind of posited that in the early years of the church, the bishop would celebrate Mass, and he kind of like, you know, extemporaneously pray. And there's something to that, but it's not quite the way it was being advanced in the 20th century. The reality is we just don't know a lot about those centuries. And it was said that, oh, well, you know, Mass was said facing the people. So this was just kind of thrown out there as a thing, and people are like, well, that's what the liturgical experts, that's what the scholars are saying, right? Then there was another book, Alcuin Reed, who is a dear friend of mine. He is a monk in France now. He's an Australian. He wrote a book called The Organic Development of the Liturgy. And he tried to show how the liturgy developed organically from the beginning until 1965, right? That there was not a lot of central Vatican control of the liturgy, even after 1588 to a certain degree. With the unsaid conclusion that Bonini and Concilium, the reform of the 1960s, is without precedent in history. It is an unprecedented thing in the history of the church to have a liturgical reform like we had after Sacrosanctum Concilium. Now, the other phenomenon that has gained momentum in the church is the witness of young people, families, priests, and religious who have come back into full communion with the church after having been associated with the traditionalist movement of Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. Marcel Lefebvre is an interesting character. He is almost single-handedly responsible for converting a significant part of French West Africa. He was excommunicated by John Paul II in 1988 for consecrating four bishops contrary to the mandate of the Holy See. It's an automatic excommunication for that. But Lefebvre, really, after the council, was very disturbed by a lot of things and had an organization called the Society of St. Pius X, who really was influential in preserving the liturgical and theological kind of ethos from before Vatican II. And so, little by little, lots of his followers began to come back into full communion with the church. And then people who had never been associated with Lefebvre in any shape or form then began to come into contact with some of these ideas again, and it kind of grew. Well, Benedict XVI in 2007 issued a motu proprio. Remember, we go back to this type of document, right, that we talked about with Paul VI. He wrote this motu proprio. I'm running out of board space here. Okay. Called Summorum Pontificum. Which clarified that when Paul VI proposed the new order of Mass, he did not abolish the classical Roman form of the Mass, and that it could coexist in the church with the new order of Mass. He then dispelled the cloud of suspicion and opprobrium which had been hanging over millions of these so-called traditionalist faithful worldwide. Okay. Summorum Pontificum in 2007 was a game changer because it basically said, you know, Paul VI did not abolish the classical Roman rite. He didn't abolish it. Okay. Because everyone before was like, ooh, I don't know if these people are celebrating this Mass. I mean, they're obviously not faithful to the church because they don't say Mass the way that we do. And Benedict XVI, after, and this is about appropriate, it's done by his own initiative, but it's after a whole canonical and theological investigation that had gone on since, I think, 1982. I mean, this is not something that came out of the blue. And they're like, well, no, this is the liturgy of the church. It's okay. If you go to this Mass, then you're not somehow not Catholic. Now, Benedict's theology, together with all this new scholarship and this kind of vigor of classically minded Catholics, has propelled a desire to reform the reform and recover the church's liturgical heritage. Remember in the stuff that we gave out last week, you had that article by Helen Hall Hitchcock, right? As a means of kind of, you know, getting our minds around, you know, what this is all coming from. Now, two of the key pieces of this idea of the reform of the reform as presented by Benedict and the liturgical movement are actually things that the pastoral branch of the liturgical movement sought to eradicate, okay, because they said that they were spurious on pastoral, theological, and historical bases that now we know is not really the case. Two things: the restoration of the eastward position at the altar and the language and music proper to the Roman liturgy, Latin and Gregorian chant. As Ratzinger pointed out in his 2003 preface to a book written by Uwe Michael Lang, who is a prince of a guy. He's part of the Oratory in London, just one of the most splendid people I've ever met in my life. He wrote a book called Turning Towards the Lord, Orientation in Liturgical Prayer. Ratzinger wrote the preface for this. Quote, "To the ordinary churchgoer, the two most obvious effects of the liturgical reform of the Second Vatican Council seem to be the disappearance of Latin and the turning of the altars toward the people. Those who read the relevant text will be astonished to learn that neither is in fact found in the decrees of the council." End quote. Okay. If you did your homework, then you will not have seen those things which most people associate with Vatican II. They're not in the documents. They're nowhere to be found. In fact, the contrary. Now, I want to talk about these two things. Okay. Remember this pastoral branch of the liturgical movement. Okay. They thought, and not entirely without reason, okay, that greater visibility to the rites and their simplification would enhance participation in them. Okay. They also based their intuition on the assumption that in the early church, Mass was said facing the people in a more simple manner than what was to be had on the eve of the Second Vatican Council. Okay. Now, there's some historical and theological issues with this. Okay, first of all, and this is something which seems very strange to us. It really does. The early Christians always prayed facing east, and that position was totally independent of that of the celebrant relative to the altar. In Rome, there's a huge exception to this, was it found that the priest stood behind the altar instead of in front of it. Why? Remember, if you've been to the Roman Basilica, there's a ginormous hole in front of most of the altars, because that's called the confessio, where you go down to see the relics of whoever the altar is in front of. If you go to St. Peter's, if you stand in front of the altar, yeah, so you can't. It's impossible. So the priest was behind it, but then the people would actually turn their backs to the altar during the Eucharistic prayer so that they could face east, the direction of the rising sun. Remember this kind of, this is another one of our fun church words, eschatological, okay, going towards the end times, this eschatological element of the liturgy, the element of waiting for the second coming of Christ, was more important in the early church's praxis than that of being able to see what was going on at the altar. From what we know, that the early Christians, they really were not all that interested in what Father was doing with the bread and wine. Sometimes, people are like, "Well, Father, I can't see what you're doing at the altar." And I'm like, "I'm just putting a little water in the wine and making the sign of the cross. It's not a cooking show. I mean, what are you seeing? What are you..." It's really not that interesting. I'm not sitting here like trying to hide this from you. It's not really that interesting. As far as the mechanical actions that are happening at the altar, it's always terribly interesting, the internal reality of it. And so people will object, "Well, but did Jesus celebrate the Lord's Supper with his back to the disciples?" How many of you have heard that? So, and it is a question that should be entertained, right? I mean, we can't just, say, "Well, that's just a dumb question." It's not a dumb question. It's a very useful question. Recent archaeological discoveries have, come to a consensus that in first century Palestine, the arrangement of the Passover table was not like a normal dinner table nowadays, but with the guest seated on the convex side of a semicircular table. They were all on the same side. Now, this seems weird to us because this is just really random to us. I mean, who would ever go to dinner at a table like this? This is weird. But that seems to be the case in this part of the ancient world at that particular point in time. No one who has ever advanced the versus populum argument, that is, for Mass facing the people, has ever been able to produce a single literary text, archaeological artifact, or piece of art which shows anything about the position of the celebrant relative to the altar in the ancient church. Historically, there is absolutely no basis for it at all. After Vatican II, everybody just whipped around based on what? You can't prove something that doesn't exist. Now,
Theologically, theologically, there's a problem as well. Okay, I want you to think about the two parts of the Mass. Okay, the Liturgy of the Word and the Liturgy of the Eucharist. Right, the nature of the Liturgy of the Word is proclamation and dialogue. Right, okay, to which address and response properly belong. Okay, why do I look at you during the Liturgy? Well, because I'm talking to you, right? Or because the readings are being proclaimed to you. This makes sense, right? But in the Liturgy of the Eucharist, the priest leads the people in prayer. Okay? He leads them by being at their head. If the altar divides him from his people, that he's leading them to themselves and not to God. Ratzinger talks about this becomes this closed circle this way. And not to God, who has historically been prayed to by Christians by the eastward position, and in the Catholic tradition, towards the image of the crucified or to the reserved sacrament. Okay. And I know that there are people who are going to say the argument, well, you know, but it's not directional east anyway. So because in our church, we wouldn't be celebrating the directional east. Well, that's not really the point. The idea is towards what is called liturgical east. The idea of everyone on the same side toward that image of the crucified Lord. Now, the interesting thing is in all of this that two consultors to concilium, who were really behind a lot of the liturgical reform. And these are names that, you know, as you come across lots of things about Vatican II, you'll come across here. Josef Jungmann and Louis Bouillet, and a lot of their stuff is really very good. They both insistently denied the theological and historical sense of Mass facing the people. Okay, they're just like, What is this? Where is this coming from? These were people who were on concilium, right? So these are, I mean, this is not, you know, super reactionary people on the Congregation for Rights. These were people who were architects of the liturgical reform. Who said, I don't know where this stuff is coming from. Right. Now, the Latin, that's another thing, is also a crucial element of the reform of the reform. Not only does it in a very real way help to incarnate the principle of the hermeneutic of continuity in the liturgy itself by restoring to the faithful the language of prayer common to the Catholic West since the 4th century. The idea is not, nobody speaks it so it's mysterious. That's not the point of Latin. The point is that it is a common language to all of us. Think about, you know, how when Muslims read the Quran, it is in Arabic. That when Jews do their prayers, it is in Hebrew. Now, there's also a really fascinating story about the restoration of Hebrew, but I'll get to that later. This assures that the literary, musical, and theological heritage of the church is not only preserved as if they were museum pieces, but are restored to life in the church's prayer. Tradition is continued, and a common language of prayer can foster a universal Catholic identity in a global multicultural church. Now, these two ideas, orientation of liturgical prayer and Latin, are in no way opposed to the council. Okay. On the first count, the eastward position is even assumed by the rubrics of the new order of Mass, which states that when I turn around and say, pray, brethren, that my sacrifice and yours, well, the little red direction says the priest turns to face the people and says, well, why would he turn to face the people and say that if he's already facing the people? Again, but you got to read the little red directions that people don't read. Okay, so again, the Missal presupposes this. And on second, it is clear that Sacrosanctum Concilium itself assumes that the amplified use of the vernacular, I mean, it says there has to be space for the vernacular, but not to supplant the Latin heritage of Christendom, but to complement it. It's not either or, but both and. Now, what's going to happen? Okay, this is what is very strange, and permit me one little moment of editorializing here, but Sacrosanctum Concilium, in one sense, is probably the most successful of the documents of the Council, because it was preceded by very long preparation of theology and spirituality. I mean, it's a very good document when it comes to theology, but the practical application of it has led to all kinds of just very, you know, interesting phenomena that we're still kind of dealing with, you know, 50, 60 years after the council. All of this reform of the reform stuff, all this other stuff that's going on, is it leading to more confusion? Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's why, one of the many reasons why I want you to read these documents, okay? I had a professor in college who said, you know what, you may never be able to change anybody's mind about anything, but at least you'll know the truth. Yeah. This is what Vatican II says and why it's important and where it's coming from. And you know, whether you know you or I agree or disagree with any of it is entirely irrelevant. The idea is what it says and where it came from is what it is. And we have to, you know, accord it that respect. Now, for next class, okay, Mystici Corporis, which is Pius XII's encyclical, and Lumen Gentium, because we're going to talk about the nature of the church next week. Now, I want you to get out your, it's Father Smith's, did Vatican II really say that quiz? Do you have it with you? Did you do your homework and bring it with you? Okay, get that out. Alrighty then. Okay, we have 16 true or false questions. Number one. The church says the new mass is better than the old mass. True or false?
False.
Okay. Number two, that is false. Yes. And see where I said that number four, right? That is go to Sacrosanctum Concilium paragraph number four and see what it says because it's related to that question. Okay. Number two, when a priest baptizes, it's just a human ritual. Okay. False. When we are, number three, when we are at mass, it's only our community that's there. Okay. Number four, liturgy is just some frou-frou stuff we don't need to study. Okay. Yay, because otherwise y'all wouldn't be here. Okay, number five, a priest or a liturgy committee can fashion the liturgy to suit them. Six, we should recognize special groups of people at Mass. Okay, this is... Okay, I'm gonna make a little comment on this.
But in the paragraph that I read, it said
okay, good, good. That at the prayer of the faithful, at the general intercession. Okay, I'm glad that you caught that. Good, 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 good. That there is a focus for that, but the Mass itself is a public Mass of all of the people, right? And this is one of those things that you see often in certain parishes. I was in a parish once in which every Sunday, like the Mass had to have a theme. And the theme was, this week is firefighters, or this week is, you know, first responders, or this week is little children. And it was just, I mean, it got to the point of like, wait a minute, what Sunday are we celebrating? And so then all of a sudden, everything that could be changed in the liturgy started to kind of morph into this. And then people in the parish are like, well, but, you know, we have the Basket Weavers Club, and we want our own Sunday, and why can't we have this Sunday? And it was just complete chaos, right? Well, Vatican II says, okay, you can mention the Basket Weavers in the Prayer of the Faithful. Don't entirely change, you know, the 22nd Sunday of ordinary time to be Basket Weaving Sunday. Now, okay, number seven. Latin is abolished and Mass has to be in English. Eight, Father Smith should stop trying to get us to sing and to go to coffee and donuts. Aha, right, okay, good. So, go to coffee and donuts, hang out with your friends after Mass, but sing, sing, sing. Okay, number nine, liturgy talk is just old stuff that has nothing to do with real life. False. 10, priests should give up trying to teach us to sing in Latin. We have a lot of false here, don't we? Okay, number 11, we should have the precious blood at every Mass. Okay, this is something that I come across occasionally, and it's a very difficult thing to kind of deal with because it's related to so many things. Remember that, again, Sacrosanctum Concilium is not really, gives certain indications when the precious blood can be given at Mass, right? But one of the things that has happened, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having the precious blood at Mass. Okay, let me preface that. Okay. Well, this is the thing. Yes, it is at the Mass on the altar. It's there, right? The distribution of the precious blood to the faithful at every Mass is not envisioned by Sacrosanctum Concilium. It's not envisioned by the rubrics of the Mass. Sometimes people will come to me, and I'll tell you this, 98% of the time, the question will be, Father, why don't we have wine at Mass? And my answer is, because you just called it that. And they look at me and they're like, wait, what? I'm like, because it ain't wine at that point. I did not choose to be a celibate for a cracker and grape juice. Forget that. No. Why don't we have the wine at Mass? Because it's not wine. Well, why don't we have... Well, you know what I mean. Well, no, I don't, actually. Because if you're a Lutheran, remember that you believe that it is bread and wine and body and blood, that then after the celebration itself is no longer body and blood, but is bread and wine. So are you a Lutheran?
Or are you just a Calvinist who believes it's just a symbol and it's just wine? Okay. If you are, then that's lovely. There are great churches down the street for you to go to. Okay. Not that I would ever tell them this, obviously, but this is what's going through my mind, right? Remember that at the Council of Trent, there was, and again, this is very philosophical language, this whole idea of concomitance, okay? Because Christ is one, right? When we receive communion, we don't receive his femur or his tibia or his colon or his spleen, okay? We receive Christ, okay? And so we receive the risen Christ under the sacramental veils. And so when you receive one species or the other, you receive the whole Christ. So when you receive one species, you are not somehow lacking because you're not receiving the other one. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with having the precious blood at Mass. This is not the point. But the theological truth of what is called concomitance, that, you know, it's all in there, right, that you receive the whole Christ, is so important that when people lose sight of that and they use the legitimate sign value of the separate species, and they elevate that into something which is not actually Catholic teaching, and that is very dangerous because it's one of the things which wreaks havoc on the kind of the integrity of the Catholic doctrine of the Eucharist. Okay. And I think that, you know, we live in an age in which that doctrine has been assailed in all kinds of different ways. And so protecting this doctrine, which was defined solemnly at the Council of Trent of concomitance, is super important to preserve our belief in the real presence. Now, okay, so, sorry, that was a lot about that one question. Number 12, the Liturgy of the Hours is not for ordinary folk. Okay. False, right? The Liturgy of the Hours for many centuries had become almost exclusively the domain of priests. Even nuns in many convents didn't actually do the Liturgy of the Hours. They did these prayers that were kind of lightly inspired by the Liturgy of the Hours, like the Little Office of the Blessed Virgin and all that. But Vatican II is saying the Liturgy of the Hours is something that it's common to everyone. Think about Sunday Vespers, right? In the entire Diocese of Charleston, the only two parishes that have the Liturgy of the Hours on a consistent basis on Sunday is St. Mary's downtown and Prince of Peace. That's it. We have Vespers on Sunday. St. Mary's does it during Lent and Advent. We have Vespers during the Green Sundays, and then Compline during Lent and Advent. We're it. The Vatican Council says everybody should be doing this. Why aren't we doing this? Okay. Number 13, priests don't have to say their breviary in Latin anymore. So, you can get special permission for it. The assumption is that priests are still doing their prayers in Latin. I can count on one hand how many priests in the Diocese of Charleston I know still say their prayers in Latin. So, because they don't know the Latin. They don't know the Latin. So, yeah. I'm sorry? Not doing the breviary is under the pain of mortal sin, but not the language. The language is not. But we're supposed to receive a special permission. Like, you have to ask the bishop for permission to say the office of the vernacular. Nobody does this, which is also a problem. But most priests, because they haven't read Sacrosanctum Concilium, they haven't read this paragraph, so they don't actually know this. This is an important thing, because again, the idea is that the Latin is a living part of the church's tradition, and certainly of a priest's spiritual tradition. And if you have a priest who doesn't even know enough Latin to celebrate the Liturgy of the Hours according to the Sacrosanctum Concilium of Vatican II, then the problem is that you can't fault many of these priests because they were never taught the Latin. They were never taught the Latin. And it's really hard for a lot of these priests, they really want to do these things and they want to do the right thing, but they really have never been given the tools by the church herself, which is a problem. So, but that's above my pay grade, so.
Are you saying that most priests in the Diocese of Charleston have not read Sacrosanctum Concilium?
I'm not saying that exactly. I'm saying that some of them have not. And all these other documents. I know that because, I mean, we talk to each other all the time. Or if they read them, then they're certainly not doing anything about them. Which is sad, but it's true. Number 14, Gregorian chants should have pride of place in liturgical services.
True.
Sometimes people, they hear Gregorian chant, and I have to say, chant is one of those, if it's done badly, it's awful. It's just Yeah, I mean, and sometimes people say, oh my God, that sounds like a dirge. And of course, the first thing I think is, do you know why it's a dirge? And I'm thinking, because that's actually the first antiphon for Matins of the Dead. It's Didi J. Me Domine, direct my path, O Lord. Because people don't know that. They just throw out the word dirge, they don't even know what it comes from. It's actually an antiphon to the divine office. But anyway, so Gregorian chant, when it's done badly, is really just terrifying. But when it's done beautifully, you know, when it's done well, it really is quite wonderful. And Vatican II is saying that the faithful need to be able to sing their parts of the Mass in Latin, in Gregorian chant. Not just a choir or a scola, that everybody needs to be doing this. But as you know, I can tell you that there is literally one school in the Diocese of Charleston where the children, every school Mass, do the ordinary of the Mass in Latin, as is prescribed by Sacrosanctum Judaeum. It's here. I'm not doing it because I'm a Latin freak. You know, Latin's a great language, but I'm not really this big Latin. But the council says for us to do this, right? Okay. I'm just like, just do it. It's in here. Just do it. Okay, number 15. Remember I said that I messed up here. We should really buy a nice pipe organ for Prince of Peace. Wait a minute, what does paragraph 120 say?
True.
Okay, so if you can write me a check for $1 million, I will kiss your feet. Okay, and so will Alan Reed. Okay, number 16. Songs by Peter, Paul, and Mary are totally acceptable for Mass.
False.
False, that's right.
With Peter, Paul, and Mary.
One of the... Good point. Ah, okay, good. That's right. Okay. It was a trick question and I didn't know it. Now, I say this because in the parish where I did this, this is really interesting. You know, one of the priests who was in the parish, you know, would tell these stories. He was in the seminary in the 1970s, and he said that quite literally they had songs by Peter, Paul, and Mary, the group from the 70s. This is even before my time, so I don't know. I wouldn't recognize any of these songs if I'd heard them. But they would sing these during Mass in the seminary. And that when he, was like, okay, I can't do this anymore, was when they wanted to substitute, what was it, like rice cake and Coke or something like that for bread and wine. And it was like, no. There's a reason why these documents, why John Paul II is like, sweet Jesus, we have to rein all this nonsense in, right? So, okay, write down the paragraph where Sacrosanctum Concilium says the following. Okay, this is kind of a tricky thing. Okay, number one, Vatican II got rid of indulgences. Have you ever heard this before? Okay, I'm glad that most of you haven't heard this. This is great. So, okay, some of you have heard that before. There are people who are like, oh, indulgences, that's so pre-Vatican II. Well, so is Jesus. Okay. You know, the whole thing about indulgences, Vatican II doesn't really say anything about indulgences. It's on their radar screen. Where there is the document Indulgentiatum Doctrina, paragraphs 1 and 5, which talk about, yeah, indulgences are kind of, you know, part of the Church's life. There was a very serious attempt to kind of reformulate the theology of indulgences, because the reality is that some people have some very strange notions. And I have to admit that even I was in the seminary before, you know, if you look at old prayer books, you'll see, like, how many days or years of indulgence that are attached to certain things. So, like, if you made the sign of the cross, it was 300 days, and if you made the sign of the cross, holy, it was like 3 years. And so I was like, sweet, this is great. I can get like 3 years off purgatory for making the sign of the cross holy. Well, let's do this. Let's keep on doing it because I need all the help I could get. Well, that's not actually the case. That wasn't the point of it. But the way that many Catholics thought of indulgences on the eve of the council was conditioned by things that were really not correct. So the document Indulgentiatum Doctrina applies Sacrosanctum Concilium. It applies the kind of new thinking to indulgences without saying there's no indulgences anymore. Number two, we shouldn't have all this music and chanting stuff at Mass. That is false, right? Musicum Sacrum. Here is another fun document that nobody ever reads and they don't know it exists. I actually have had conversations with some of my brethren about this who have never heard of this document. 1967, the official post-Vatican II document about music in the sacred liturgy. Talks about how the sung liturgy is the form of liturgy. There are many Catholics who, remember
especially on the eve of the council, it was very common to have what was called low mass, right? The priest would read the prayers at the altar server would respond. In some very advanced parishes, the people would respond to some things, but not, it wasn't terribly common. And then, in places that were highfalutin on a high holy day, then you might have somebody singing hymns on top of the action, right? Which were totally divorced from the actual thing, prayers that were being said by the priest. In reality, that low mass with hymns mentality has been transferred to the Novus Ordo. And in many places, basically what we have is a red mass by the priest where people or a choir sings a bunch of stuff that has no connection with what is actually the text appropriate for that moment, right? This is most people's experience of the mass. So, Musicam Sacram is like, no. But we're still doing it almost everywhere. 1967, Musicam Sacram. Okay, number three. Keep it simple, stupid, when it comes to music in church. Okay. There are many people, and there's an ideology behind this, which says that all of the music at Mass should be immediately accessible to the people, and that only the faithful really should be singing at Mass. So in other words, you don't need to have choirs, and you certainly don't need to have, you know, like polyphonic settings of the Mass from the Renaissance and all this stuff. Musicam Sacram is like, no. The church's treasury of sacred music is still the treasury of sacred music and is still part of our worship, and we should use it. Okay. Number four, the choir cannot sing by themselves. They're there just to support us, right? Musicam Sacram 16 says, no, that's not the point. The choir actually has its own role and can do things independently of the congregation. I say this because, again, especially in the 1970s and 80s, there really was, especially in the American kind of liturgical establishment, this idea that basically all the choir was supposed to do was support congregational singing, right? And that if they were doing something outside of that, then they were just being performance artists, and that has nothing to do with the liturgy. And things that are too kind of artsy, in quotes, do not have a place in the liturgy. Whereas Musicam Sacram says, no, that's not the case. Number five, we should talk in church. Musicam Sacram 17, silence. Silence is important, is integral to the sacred liturgy. There are many places where you go to Mass and it is like cocktail hour before, during, and after Mass. It's really incredible. And people will say, well, that's what Vatican did. We're a community. We need to celebrate each other. We need to celebrate. And that's true. I mean, there's something true to that. But silence has an integral part of the sacred liturgy before, during, and after the Mass. Number six, there is no such thing as solemn Mass anymore. Right. So, remember before the council with the liturgy, there were these kind of gradations of Mass, right? You had low Mass, you had sung Mass, you had solemn high Mass, and then you had pontifical Mass, right? The liturgical reform kind of gives a lot of flexibility there, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, because it basically kind of recognizes that, you know, different places have different resources, and maybe they can carry off some of it, but not all of it, and that's okay. So that's kind of a good kind of part of the flexibility of the new rites, which is actually very helpful, because it means that you can make inches toward doing really great things, but if you can't do the whole kit and caboodle at one time, then it's okay. There were many people for whom the whole idea of solemn Mass, you know, with deacons and incense and all this kind of stuff, they're like, well, that is totally contrary to the spirit of the council, which is all about simplicity. Well, that's not what Musicam Sacram says. Okay. Number eight, we can have organs. I'm sorry, number seven. Latin should never be sung at a Mass with English. Musicam Sacram 51. Remember, it's both and, right? It's both Latin and the vernacular.
You should probably avoid it in Russia.
Oh, right. So, well, maybe. So, number eight, we can have organ solos during Lent. Yeah, Musicam Sacram, paragraph 66. This is one of the things that, I have to say, is almost, you know, ubiquitous, is that during Lent and Advent, in many places, the organ is blaring as if it's Easter Sunday. And really, the organ should only be used, if at all, to sustain congregational singing. Because the idea is that Lent and Advent are, you know, we reduce certain things from the senses. I have been in churches and cathedrals on Good Friday, where the organ was deafening.
And it's like, but Musicum Sacrum says this, why are you doing this? Now, of course, the problem is that, you know, I mean, Bach wrote some really fantastic Lenten organ music. Oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's just beautiful, and I love hearing it. But it's not really what we're supposed to be doing during Mass. Maybe we should have more like organ concerts during Lent, or devotional services where we can do these things, because, I mean, this organ repertoire is amazing. Advent is another example. I mean, you know, the German organ repertoire for Advent is spectacular, but that's not the Roman liturgy. It's not about an organ concert. We still should do these things. Those are really cool, but not at Mass. Number 9, the Eucharistic prayer has to be said out loud. Well, remember we talked about all these documents kind of like contradicting each other? Eucharistico Mysterium makes it sound like the Eucharistic prayer has to be audible, but it does not have to be, because remember that the Eucharistic prayer in the old rite was in silence, right? It was in absolute silence. The idea that all of the prayers should be kind of, you know, audible, but not necessarily screamed out at a very loud voice. Subsequent documents seem to indicate a preference for the Eucharistic prayer being heard in an audible voice, but not necessarily the same register or level as the other prayers. It's kind of murky when you start trying to, this one particular question, and you look at all the documents, and it's like, you know, it's like watching a heart monitor of someone who's dying or something. You're like, well, what is this? Is it up or is it down or what is it? Number 10, Mass time should be whenever it's convenient to for me, so have some more. One of the interesting things, this is a very fascinating thing. One of the interesting things about the liturgical movement was there really was an idea of unity of celebration, that you have one of things, right? Even to the point where they would push this thing of having one ginormous chalice that everybody would drink out of. You have these things from the 1970s. I mean, the most bizarre thing. Like, you know, chip and dip bowls and things that people would use. And then someone woke up and said, this is extremely impractical. Let's not do this because this is dumb. But it was very common because of the symbol value. And so the idea of the entire parish community coming together as one for one celebration of the liturgy, and that was the thing that really was the center of your day, of the Lord's Day, is very powerful. And it was one of the things that the liturgical movement was very insistent on kind of saying really needs to be part of this. But what has happened since the Council is that this kind of idea of the liturgical movement, which is enshrined in Eucharistico Mysterium, is just absent. So now the idea of Mass should be for the convenience of the faithful, right? And if we have to have a multiplication of masses in order to do that for people's convenience, then we need to do that. As a pastoral consideration, I understand that. As a theological consideration, and ultimately pastoral, it's a disaster. Because I think that there is something about an entire parish family coming together for one celebration of the Eucharist, and that being the thing that drives all of your other choices about how to celebrate the Lord's Day, is extremely useful. When the tail begins to wag the dog, we begin to cause problems. Okay. But of course, you know, most priests are, you know, very reticent to do this because they see their collections going down. That's the flat out reality of it. We have 6 masses a weekend at Prince of Peace. We do not need 6 masses a weekend at Prince of Peace. The whole reason that the church was built as large as it was so that we would have fewer masses. We actually have more masses now than we had before. Okay. So, is this in line with what the liturgy document is kind of getting at, of drawing us into the liturgy as a community? No. Does it have a certain kind of divisive element to it within a parish? Yes. Now, of course, we have the situation here where we have 2 forms of the Roman Rite, so there's already kind of another thing that's there. And we have three languages. We have Latin, English, and Spanish. So we have another kind of thing there that's part of the dynamic. But with the other masses, think about what it would be. And think about what happens when we have things like Holy Thursday, right? Or Easter Sunday, when we only have, you know, we have fewer masses, or Christmas. I mean, they're packed to the rafters. But there's a whole different sense of those masses than when, you know, we have the normal kind of Sunday schedule of all these 6 masses because, well, I need to be at the lake all day so I can do my last chance mass at 6:00. Okay, that's fine. And, you know, I'm not going to cancel any of these masses, but it's not really in this vision, is it? Now, number 11, communion rails should be ripped out of churches. We don't need them. Again, this is one of these things. It's like, you know, high altars and communion rails and statues and things were ripped out of churches, you know, on orders from on high. Why? A Christian Museum does not say anything about this. 12, the bishops at Vatican II were in favor of communion in the hand. Yeah. This is not part of Vatican. It is nothing. Memoriale Domini is the document which talks about communion in the hand for the first time. Vatican II, not on the radar screen. 13, we don't really have to kneel for the consecration. There are many places, and this is very interesting. In the South, we never had this so much, but there were certain places in which people were forced to stand during the Eucharistic prayer. And then, in some places, they were forced to stand during the distribution of communion, which I have to think is just uncomfortable for people. I mean, just standing there all this time. This is something which, you know, the general instruction of the Roman Missal is like, no, you got to kneel for the consecration. One of the interesting things that the United States has a particular law in which we kneel for the entirety of the Eucharistic prayer and then after the, you know, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. It's very strange. We're the only country that has this. The Roman custom is that you kneel during the consecration and that's it. You know, partially because remember the Roman basilicas, I mean, they don't have pews, right? You don't have cushy, you know, fun kneelers to sink into. I mean, you know, you kneel for the consecration and that's it. You know, if I would have my druthers, we would, you know, preserve the Roman traditions and everything. Because I think because even the prayer, there's a prayer of the Roman canon where it's also, you know, circumstantes al altar, that we're standing around the altar. We're not, it doesn't, you know, even the Eucharistic prayer assumes that we're standing, just not during the consecration. But there was this ideology which was pushed in many places against kneeling as a sign of adoration to the Blessed Sacrament. Remember how we talked about how some people use this idea of like, well, if you're a mature Christian, then you know you don't need to kneel in subservience to a master. But that's not what the church says. Number 14, black vestments cannot be used in funerals. Okay, general instruction. Yes, black is an option. Right. One of the things that is very interesting is that there are three colors for funerals which are allowed. Black, purple, and white. White is interesting, and I'll tell you why. White was allowed before the council in Asian cultures where white was the color of mourning. Now, here's where things get kind of strange, because the post-Vatican II kind of funeral rite, in many respects, is done very well, because, in certain respects, it's kind of strange, but in many respects, it kind of recovers the paschal character. And there's lots of prayers about the resurrection of Christ. It's very centered on the resurrection of Christ. And I think that there's something very positive about that in the liturgical reform, in the new order of funerals. But, like, for example, you know, you go to a funeral now and you've got the paschal candle because of baptism, and they're making all these kind of connections. And all of that is all a fruit of the theology behind Sacrosanctum Concilium. It's all perfectly fine so far as it goes. But the point of the white vestments was not actually to express the paschal character, but because it was the color of mourning in certain cultures. The United States received the permission for white, but in many places it has become kind of part and parcel of this very interesting phenomenon that is going on with people in which they just don't want to accept the reality of death. You see people, I want my funeral to be a celebration. And it's like, well, okay. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with celebrating the life of someone who's passed. I mean, that we need to do that. That's a great thing. It's a wonderful thing. The prayers of the liturgy are about the paschal mystery and that transitus, that passing over to eternal life. And all that is beautiful and fantastic and is wonderful. But to celebrate funerals as if they're instantaneous canonization ceremonies with the same color that we use for saints, are we sending the wrong message? It's just, it makes me very uncomfortable. Purple is used, which is very strange because it's just like, well, black is too somber for some people, so we'll use the next best thing, which is purple. So in most countries, purple is the normative color for funerals. But it's still kind of made up. I mean, why purple? I mean, purple is associated with penance and with the royal kingship of Christ. It doesn't really have anything to do with it. It's just kind of an odd thing. But all these things are used. My default in the parish is black vestments. If someone has a very strong feeling for another color, then it's allowed. So I'm not going to say, well, no, I'm not going to use black vestments at your funeral. Well, it's allowed by the church, so fine. I mean, you know. And sometimes people, they do have very strong feelings about this. No, I'm not going to have a fight over the color of the vestments when the church gives us an option. But it is important to realize that these things are part of a larger kind of cultural phenomenon that is happening, that is related to the revision of the liturgical text in one way, in a positive way, but has been kind of, you know, dripped through the prism of a very weird kind of thing going on in our culture, which is just not really dealing with the reality of death and grief and all of those things. Number 15, if I'm in mortal sin, I can just say a prayer and go to communion. Okay, Eucharistice Sacramento. This is another one of these little documents that nobody reads, right? Because you can't even find them. I come across this. It's amazing. I come across this all the time, where priests have told people that, you know, well, if you can't get a confession, then, you know, just say the act of confession, it'll be fine. Go to communion, it'll be fine. And it's like, no, that's not what the church actually says. First of all, because we've developed this idea that, you know, if I go to Mass and I don't receive communion, then I'm missing out and I might as well not be there, right? Which is, you know, it's a good thing to receive communion, obviously, frequently, but we still worship God, and we are bound to worship God, even if we don't receive communion. So people will get into this thing where they're like, but I'm a Mass, but I have to receive communion. Or, but if I don't get up for communion, then, you know, well, my wife is going to think I'm like, you know, having an affair or something, or so I've got to go. And it's like, no. And in many parishes, and you have this thing where, you know, God bless the ushers. They really are wonderful people. But, you know, they're like, you know, stormtroopers trying to get everybody in these nice lines to go up to Holy Communion. And it's like, no, just let people go to communion. It's fine. Number 16, Mass should be said facing the people. Right. So the general instruction, just again, it presumes that that's not the case. Okay, so we have gone through a lot tonight. I told you this was going to be a long one, so we're going to have 15 minutes for questions. If you need to go, perfectly understandable. And remember, I reserve the right to punt a question until later, or not. So depending on it. So, yeah, go. Okay, I missed that. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. When the priest comes down to the altar with the crucifix, everybody's facing the altar. They love the heck out of you. They always face the priest. Why is this?
Okay, this is a really cool question, actually. So I've never really thought of this before, I guess. If you go to a wedding, you know, as soon as you hear comes the bride, then everybody turns to the church door, so you got to see the bride coming on in. But yet, when the priest comes in procession, then everybody's facing the altar. Okay. As far as the bride thing is concerned, remember that the church in her marriage rites has a huge flexibility as to these things. And a lot of these things are not prescribed at all. Like, when we think of, like, what happens at a wedding, like getting everybody to the altar at a wedding, none of that is really particularly prescribed by the church. The church kind of envisions that you have a proper liturgical procession like you'd have at Mass. But we have all these customs that we kind of do. So it's totally kind of irrelevant. I mean, yeah, people just do what they want at these things. As far as the priest coming in, it seems appropriate to greet the celebrant and the procession in some way, in that manner, so that everyone faces the cross and then everyone would kind of turn on the way to the altar. In many churches, you'll see that when the priest, or when the cross, or when the celebrant, or both, when they pass, then they'll bow, which many Anglo-Catholics have that custom. Sometimes you see this in certain places in Europe as well. It's just kind of one of those things that has never really been, you know, formalized. But
isn't this where you
Well, this is an interesting question. Okay, because this is related to a whole bunch of things, actually. I think a lot of people, the thought of, okay, Jesus Christ is present in the church in the tabernacle, and so I don't want to turn my back to him just to say hello to the servers and the priest. They don't want to turn their back to the Blessed Sacrament, which makes a lot of sense. This is where, I don't begin to get started with this. From the point of view of liturgical action, it is very strange to have the sacrament reserved at the altar. From the point of view of liturgical action, remember, like on Holy Thursday, the tabernacle is empty, right? For a pontifical mass with a bishop, the instruction is that the tabernacle is empty because there's something about the newness of the sacrament being confected that many liturgists would claim that having the reserved sacrament already in the sanctuary is a distraction from. I think there's something to that. So there are many churches, especially Opus Dei does this in a lot of places, where what they will do is that they will put a screen in front of the tabernacle to kind of hide the sacrament in some sense so that the liturgical action is the center and not the reserved sacrament. I think one of the interesting things that has happened in the church is that there's been such a confusion about belief in the real presence. And in many churches that were reordered so that the priest was sitting in the place where it used to be Jesus, I think there's a lot of people who are like, that just makes me uncomfortable. And having celebrated in churches like that, I'm like, what? This is not where I'm supposed to be. This is weird. This is where Jesus, because he's the center, not me. Why am I here? There was a great kind of nervousness about this. And in many churches, they have restored the tabernacle to the central axis of the church. The problem with this is that in many places, they're still facing the people. So the priest then has his back to the Blessed Sacrament when he's facing the people. So it's a very weird kind of thing. From the point of view of liturgical action, I think it makes more sense for, you know, the sacrament not to be there. But I think that because we're living through this age of tremendous disbelief in the real presence, having the reserved sacrament in the church on the central axis has a pedagogical value to it. That is very helpful. I think until we kind of correct the idea of liturgical action having its own novelty. Now, the thing is, Pius XII, Ryan, I was going to mention this, in Mediator Dei, said something which is very useful. He said that to separate the altar and the tabernacle is to separate two things that need to go together. Now, okay, he's making a theological assertion, not a historical, because historically, the tabernacle on the altar is basically relatively 16th century and forward, for the most part. There wasn't the same kind of, you know, connection. But he's saying that the kind of liturgists in the 1940s and 50s who were like, oh my gosh, all these people are being distracted. And I'm like, really? You're being Jesus is distracting you from Jesus. You know, you can be a little pedantic about these things. I think that, and also it was a reaction to this whole kind of like, well, we have these high altars that now we have to rip out. And the church is like, well, no, why would you do that? It's beautiful. Why would you need to do that? So I think tabernacle and altar have a relationship there. And especially where we are now with these things, I think that making that relationship visible to people is really super important. But from the point of view of the liturgical action, sorry, I'll give you another example. People in the liturgical movement were often very enthusiastic about you should only receive hosts that were consecrated at that Mass, and you really should not receive hosts that were taken from the tabernacle that were consecrated in the previous Mass. The idea, again, is that newness of the liturgy, that, you know, there's something new that is happening. And so you freshly receive the fruits of that sacrifice. Now, the thing is, again, you can kind of take this to extremes. I'm like, it's still Jesus. You know, Jesus that I consecrated at 8 o'clock is not going to do you harm at 10 o'clock. That's just idiotic. But there are many liturgists who, they will fight to the death for these kind of things. So I think that there's a principle that is useful here. But, you know, when you receive Jesus from the reserved sacrament, from the tabernacle, you know, I don't think anybody is sitting here like, oh Lord, this Jesus was like consecrated 2 hours ago. This is not in accord with the symbolism that I need to understand the liturgy. I mean, this is stupid, this is asinine. But, I'm sorry? Well, if you don't have enough hosts, you don't get Jesus. You can just keep on breaking them as far as you can.
Some churches where they have a chalice sitting there, and you put your hosts in, they should go
in. Sure. Right, yeah, Right, yeah. There are churches that are insistent on this, and then, you know, sometimes they end up short because of that. Yeah, Brian?
So my question goes back to where the beginning of the talk is. The fourth quarter of the page, liturgical documents that came out after Vatican II that have very important that most people haven't read and can't harmonize them, right? Can't
right.
Figure out what those what. So I've always had a problem with understanding if the same bishops that were at the council authorized the Sacrosanctum Concilium, and what we got after the council, approved by, regardless of whether it said that Sacrosanctum Concilium or not, approved by Paul VI, and there were parts of Sacrosanctum Concilium that also said we're deferred to bishops to allow certain things and things like that. They went and implemented what somebody approved in parts of these 1400 documents, what we ended up having is the mainstream of liturgy in the church for the last 50 years after that. So how can we leapfrog the 1400 pages of documents that obviously thought they were implementing that into and go back and say, we're just going to use this pure text of Sacrosanctum Concilium and compare it to what we've got going on now?
Okay. So in other words, what do we do with these 1496 pages of documents? How do we even digest all of this? Well,
I mean, they have some authority.
Well, yeah, they do. The problem is you have competing authorities at different levels that then contradict each other. This is where it becomes a huge problem. Remember that with the old liturgy, because it grew organically, it grew in such a way as that as things came to the fore, they just were integrated, and things began to be done in a certain way that they were accepted, they were written down in ceremonial books and protected by liturgical law. But because it grew organically, then all the pieces of the puzzle fit together because they grew together, right? With a liturgical reform, you have a liturgy imposed by a committee of people who were not talking to each other, and then all of a sudden you have this fracturing going on everywhere. Is it possible to kind of unify all of these things? I don't think it is, because, again, there's so many contradictions within the documents that you can't find anything. I think that if there is to be a successful reform of the reform, I think that there has to be a recognition on the part of the teaching authority of the church that this is too much stuff. And because it contradicts because of all this weirdness, that there has to be legal action basically saying, okay, all of these documents, forget it. Just scratch it all out, and here's how we're going to do this, and rethink these things. But that is problematic as well, because that is the work of a committee that has to happen. That is kind of a committee type of work. Will any of this ever be fixed in our lifetime? I doubt. I really doubt.
So.
Is it logical to look at the Missal as the normative practical document? Yes, except for the fact that in certain places the rubrics are not clear. I'll give you a very good example of this. The priest incenses the altar, period, is a rubrical instruction. Okay. How do you do that? There is one document which came out, the Audax Aequendam document, which was from 1967, which says very specifically, it is not to be assumed that if the liturgy does not prescribe something in a certain way, then you should do what was done before. Okay.
So it says that. So therefore, you say, okay, I have an official document telling me that I can't assume that I need to do what I did before. But then the question is, if you're not told how to do it, then how do you do it? So incensing the altar, if you open the old missal, there is a map that says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It actually prescribes the number of strokes and how to actually go around the altar incensing it. But what you see now is that because the rubric just says the priest incenses the altar, you know, this is where it drives me crazy. You see these priests and bishops, God bless them, they're wonderful people, but then they're just going to like randomly walk around with a fiery pot of smoke. They have no clue what they're doing. They're just walking around with it. Okay, they don't realize that there's an order to this. But the document itself, because you have a rubric in the missal, right, that says the priest incenses the altar. It doesn't tell you how. Then you have another document which says very specifically, don't assume that you should do this. And then you have another document which says that you should assume that, you know, that you do things in the customary manner. Which is organic development, right. So, you know, this is where, you know, I go back to the principle that if the Reformed rite tells you to do something in a certain way, you do it in that way. If it doesn't tell you, then you do it the old way in a way which is consistent with the spirit of the new. But sometimes that can get you into sticky wickets. So even talking about the incensing of the gifts on the altar. Well, again, okay, you had the first iteration, which is you incense the gifts. Or you may incense the gifts. It didn't tell you why. But then you had another document, which of course was not in the missal, which prescribed you to incense them as if you were incensing the gospel, so with three doubles, center, left, and right. But then you wouldn't know it's actually center, left, and right unless you consulted the ceremonial manual from before the council. Then all of a sudden you have another iteration of it, which is saying it is not to be assumed that you should do the old thing. But then you have the prefect for the Congregation for Divine Worship who is incensing the gifts in the old manner. So you're like, but he's the authoritative interpreter of the rubric. And in his practice, he's choosing to do... I mean, this is the situation that we're in.
Why is this not taught in seminaries? I mean, I guess I always naively assume that you guys go to school not only to learn how to say Mass,
right.
But why is this not being...
Why is this not being taught in seminaries? That is a $1 million question. So, I think it is because, well, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, because to me, this is kind of really important. I think in many seminaries, you have liturgists who are kind of trained in a certain aspect of these things, but without the hermeneutic of continuity. And so they don't know the tradition that they've come from. And so they just kind of come up with what they think is generally acceptable ways to do things. And then they teach seminarians these things. And it becomes really extremely problematic on the ground when you have priests who are in a parish together and they've learned to celebrate the liturgy in two entirely different ways. And then they become very like, well, this is how I'm going to do it because this is how I learned it in the seminary. And then half the time you're like, yeah, but you went to a seminary where you like literally never read the General Instructions of the Roman Missal, Dominus Chanting Liturgy, Authenticum Ecclesiae Considerandum Sacramentum. You have no clue what you're talking about, and you still walk around like you have a flaming handbag instead of a thurible incense at the altar. It is a problem. So
where's the leadership in the church? Why have the Pope not stepped forward to say, okay, we've got a big problem. We've got a huge problem. We have mass confusion. We have people leaving.
Right.
Well, but if Benedict did, then we're in a state of mass confusion.
Sure. Well, the thing is, I think that, you know, like all these documents and everything were steps in the right direction. I think that because, you know, it's like when the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. You just can't. You know, you have to find a way to get a new tube of toothpaste, I guess, and say, okay, well, this is a start all over again. The leadership of the church, I think, has given... a large amount of clarity with these things. It's just being ignored. It's just being ignored. It's as simple as that. So, yes?
So, I've heard a lot of years about religion, and, you know, I thought that I would read this document, and if I see they were supposed to do that, and I really found the document confusing. Not confusing in reading it, but it was very clear to read that they were creating confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I language hit, and then right after that, paragraphs and paragraphs of you can change it, it'll be kind of what you think, and what's, I mean, I can't remember all the wording, but it sounded just like that whole spirit of wanting to do stuff that I thought I wasn't going to find.
Right, right.
So, I mean, it sounds like there were these commissions that would be set up in all these different territories, and they could all kind of do what they thought was necessary.
Right, right. Well, because I think that the church reacted to an excessive, well, what was perceived to be an excessive centralization after 1588, where everything down to the minimal detail was prescribed. Like, literally, your right thumb is supposed to be over your left when you hold your hands in prayer was prescribed. I think at Vatican II, they're like, okay, this is a little bit much. And we need to kind of, you know, relax things a little bit and trust in people's judgment, right? So I think that the point of Sacrosanctum Concilium, and even a lot of these documents, was not to kind of micromanage every aspect of the liturgical reform, but to give principles, trusting that people would still have understood where it all came from. So it's like, okay, so you have, okay, yeah, Gregorian chant and Latin and all this stuff, but we can have some vernacular, you know, you guys know English, so y'all can translate this, it's going to be great, right? But what happens is, what are the principles by which one translates? Then all of a sudden that you know, well, how do you do that? There was a document that came out originally called Comme le prévoit, which was written in French, which proposed this thing called dynamic equivalence, that, you know, it should be kind of generally what in your language kind of generally gets to the idea. Well, Liturgium Authenticum 1994 is like, well, that was a disaster because, you know, half of the church is not even listening to any of these prayers, or because it's not even the actual translation of the Latin. So Liturgium Authenticum said, no, you need to translate it so that it actually translates the Latin in certain things. It's not just kind of a paraphrase of it. So within Sacrosanctum Concilium, there is a certain kind of ambiguity that's there, right? Because I think, and again, it's hard to say, I think that the Council Fathers kind of assumed a stability that would be there. Then, all of a sudden, you have Concilium in 1970 and this whole other thing that happened, that was imposed upon the church, which was incredibly ambiguous. And we've been kind of dealing with the fallout of that ever since.
In those 1500 pages, is there something that gives more clarity in what direction than just kind of like you're going to, I mean, it sounds to me like when you read it, they could change the entire mass.
Right. Yeah, there is a huge lack of clarity. There's a huge lack of clarity that's there, that is built into the documents themselves.
There's other document of Vatican II that says, you know, how you implement the...
No. There was documents after Vatican II which attempted to flesh out those things from those documents, so those paragraphs in the middle there. But then they kept kind of changing and going back and then going forward and all that. And we've had this like ever since. One of the things that I've been fascinated by, and this is liturgy geek stuff, is this, the rites of Holy Week. Okay. I've been celebrating the rites of Holy Week, you know, for 11 years now. And I recently read a book talking about the changes in Holy Week just in the Novus Ordo from the three different editions of the Roman Missal. And it is really surprising that there's lots of changes that are all really small things that are there. The third edition of the Roman Missal actually restores a lot of ancient things. But if you're not kind of very careful to do the comparison, you don't pick up on these things. And so many priests, you know, when they go to celebrate Holy Week, they just kind of, well, I think we kind of did this last year, and so let's just do this, and they don't actually read the text. And to a certain degree, I mean, the liturgy is something which is a tradition. It's something which is handed on. It's not a science experiment or a cooking kind of recipe. So many people kind of have this intuition as to the way that the liturgy is to be celebrated, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it does have to be kind of informed by the text themselves. But when the texts are always changing and no one's reading them, and then you have different kind of levels of authority, it really does become a little bit kind of problematic. So, yeah.
Well, I've been sitting here listening, and there's a lot of us, the history of the church here, we've lived through all that.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And the thing about it, I think it's very important to, in a way, address that. And it's almost like someone needs to write a history of what occurred here in the church and what we saw and what we experienced, and there was a lot of good stuff that we experienced. And at the same time, there was a lot of detrimental stuff from the standpoint of the old police, which taught land and being moved out. But it was part of, to me, it was part of a growth. And the thing is, it's very important to look at what we've learned, what we learned during that period of time, and some way share that. Because there was a period of time where we were more ecumenical, we were reaching out to other churches because they were Christians, whether they had slight different beliefs. And that was, I was one of the ecumenical here. And that was one of the first things we looked at one point in time. And we had, you know, we had all these different committees that were really positive groups that worked for the benefit of the church. So anyway, I just, without getting a lot of detail, it seems that there needs to be some feedback from the people that have experienced since 72 or whatever, 70s. Because they have a lot, there's a lot that is very positive and address a lot of the problems of the church. We had renewed groups where families got together and discussed the Bible. And they could, it was set up in such a way you could share what you understood. And then you discussed it, and it was a growth thing. It was really a sharing of how you felt and a true spiritual growth that occurred. So anyway, that was the problem.
Yeah. No, I think that what you're saying is really important. Yeah, I mean,
it's like Gail did. Go back to her when she was working with the, kids in Iowa.
Yeah.
And it's like that plaque up there, the stained glass woman up there. Isn't that part of your history?
Yeah, I think it is.
St. Francis, the other St. Francis, you were working with them?
No, the important thing is No, the important thing is that, you know, there is something to be said for the fact that the faithful in this parish particularly have lived, I've seen a lot. All of these kind of things we've seen just in this one parish. And that a lot of these things have, you know, came about as the church in a particular place dealt with everything that was going on in the wider church. And that has to be honored. And that experience has to be honored. And also, like, it's one of those things that, you know, you have an opening to something and you're going towards that. And then you realize, okay, well, there's other things that are part of it. And so those have to be brought to the mix. And it is part of kind of the growth of the church. And I think many Catholics, because of all of this, have come to engage the Mass and the liturgy and the sacred at a level that they might not have had before. And that's a positive thing.
Well, you know, to take like Father Kroger. Father Kroger was the one to do it. What he set it up, where there's a section there that was from the old one. I mean, the old one.
Right.
What was the old one?
Okay.
And Mueller's back there.
Right.
Yeah,
okay. Well, let's take one last question. Let's take one last question, and then we got to go because it's 9 o'clock. Yeah.
So when we talk about the ordinary form of life, if you compare that back to 1950, there's something about the Mass in 1950 that Sacrosanctum Concilium was looking at, saying we want to change to get more active participation of the people. So is the Mass, the extraordinary form of Mass we have now, the same as what it was before that, or has it been changed in some way to get more active participation of the people? So is it consistent with what the Council Fathers wanted to do, and has the change been made, or is it exactly the same?
Well, the extraordinary form, textually and ceremonially, is exactly as it was before the council. So that has not changed. The way in which the people can participate in that form, there are certain things that Pius XII already had allowed, such as the faithful doing the responses at a low mass, which can be done in the extraordinary form. And I think that many people whose experience of the ordinary form and participation in that, when they come to the extraordinary form, then a lot of times they want to do the responses, right? I mean, they want to do these things. So I think that you can celebrate the extraordinary form in a way which is not contrary to the spirit of and the text of Sacrosanctum Concilium, even though the text is not, you know, it does not include the changes. One of the things about the kind of active participation thing that I'm often kind of like, okay, because people talk about all this active participation stuff, and I'm like, okay, well, lots of Catholics, they understand the words now in a way that they might not have before, but they understand what they mean. The rites have been simplified, but do they understand them any more now than they did before? And that's not necessarily apparent. So the extraordinary form, like I said, textually is as it was. I mean, there's been no change there, really. But the spirit with which people can enter into it, because a lot of this is about interior participation, right? About conscious kind of what we're doing. And that can be done no matter what form of the liturgy is celebrated. And I think that, you know, the extraordinary form, as was celebrated in many places, and not necessarily everywhere, but as was celebrated in many places, was done in a way which, now that we have Sacrosanctum Concilium, and now we've had all this kind of liturgical insanity and chaos and all this kind of stuff, people can go back to that and they have a different and a fresh view of it, and want to participate in a very real way in whatever liturgy that they go to. Okay, so I told you this was going to be a long one. Next week is Lumen Gentium, and so that is the document on the church. And so thank you for your attention. I know 2 hours to sit here is a long, long time. And remember, we have sweets from Yvonne. So, okay, thank you for your time and for coming and doing all your reading. So, good. So.
I'm going to give one more answer out of you.
Okay. Okay, I just need to...